It is Friday, July 24th. We are looking at an expanding conflict in Iran and a messy contraction in the thoroughbred racing world. Following up on yesterday, the gaps in our infrastructure are starting to show in more places than just the Pentagon. Here is the news. The U.S. military is currently engaged in an open-ended conflict with Iran. This fight now involves recurring strikes that have expanded beyond initial military targets to include dual-use infrastructure. While the administration asserts that Iran's nuclear and military programs are destroyed, the conflict has intensified. Iran is responding through regional proxies and by targeting U.S. personnel and infrastructure in the Gulf. This has created a strategic stalemate. The administration lacks a clear plan to end the fighting without triggering the political consequences of a larger military commitment. This approach is burning through critical assets like expensive, long-range precision weapons. Because these are difficult to replace at current production speeds, the U.S. is facing a potential shortage that will eventually force a choice between major escalation or an unfavorable strategic retreat. The conflict is also shifting regional dynamics. Analysts argue that Russia and China are providing targeting intelligence to Iran, which is being used to attack sensitive U.S. and CIA facilities. This suggests the U.S. is no longer managing a contained regional dispute, but is instead caught in a broader multipolar competition. Domestic political pressure is mounting as well. Senate Armed Services Committee hearings have expressed increased scrutiny, and polling indicates that support for the conflict is dropping among the administration's core base. To make matters more complicated, there are concerns that a U.S.-backed civilian nuclear program for Saudi Arabia is now on the table. While intended as a strategic partnership, it risks triggering a regional nuclear arms race, potentially forcing the UAE to pursue similar capabilities and hardening Iran's resolve to secure its own nuclear deterrent. Turning to the economy, the Federal Reserve is shifting its policy approach under new leadership. The Fed is moving away from the rigid forward guidance used over the last 8 years in favor of a more data-dependent, agile strategy. The Fed now intends to treat each meeting as a live event to address supply-side shocks, such as energy price changes, rather than focusing solely on demand-side indicators. This shift comes as the economy transitions from a period of rapid corporate earnings growth to a slower, more sustainable pace. While this initially rattled equity markets, it represents a normal adjustment in the earnings cycle. The market is showing surprising resilience, with healthcare, consumer goods, and industrials balancing out volatility in the tech sector. This suggests the economy is less sensitive to interest rate changes than previous models projected. However, geopolitical tensions are creating a structural challenge for this monetary strategy. Significant defense spending tied to national security, rather than economic cycles, is creating persistent inflationary pressure. The Fed now faces a difficult choice: raise rates in a market already struggling with high energy costs, or accept a higher baseline for inflation. Investors should expect the era of clear, long-term Fed guidance to be over. In the political arena, a campaign in Maine recently collapsed after damaging information regarding the candidate's past surfaced. This triggered a cycle of internal distrust and staff departures that effectively ended the effort. This highlights the risks of modern populist strategies. When political strategists prioritize candidates who fit a specific populist narrative, they often skip traditional background checks to protect the candidate's outsider image. In a modern media environment where a candidate's history is under constant digital surveillance, this is a recipe for disaster. The situation is exacerbated by a growing disconnect between party establishments and their primary bases. Democrats are struggling with a tension between institutionalists who prioritize electability and an emboldened progressive wing that favors ideological purity. This divergence often results in the party fielding candidates who excite primary voters but alienate the broader coalition, including Black and middle-class voters. Republicans are facing their own internal misalignments. While party leadership prefers to focus on economic messaging, the base's focus on 2020 election results acts as a litmus test. This alienates persuadable suburban voters and creates a gap between the party's messaging and the primary economic concerns of the general electorate. Both parties are currently trapped by the demands of their respective extremist bases, which prioritize symbolic victories over the coalition building necessary to govern. This dysfunction is leaving a mark on younger voters. Gen Z is experiencing a sense of political homelessness as they view the current system as an insider game designed to serve corporations rather than the public. The progressive movement has struggled to provide a clear, practical alternative to this cynicism, often relying on reactive, high-cost interventions, like military action in Mali, rather than proactive development or effective local governance. Public health is also showing signs of strain. According to reports, cases of cyclosporiasis, a parasitic infection, have quadrupled to over 11,000 across 41 states. This points to a systemic failure in the U.S. food safety apparatus, largely driven by staffing cuts and the loss of specialized expertise at the FDA and CDC. The crisis highlights a vulnerability in the nationalized food supply chain. Large agricultural aggregators provide uniform produce to national chains, creating single points of failure. When contamination occurs, the centralized nature of these supply chains ensures that a localized issue becomes a nationwide outbreak. Because federal agencies have lost the institutional knowledge required for labor-intensive tracing, they are currently unable to verify the origins of the contamination. This information vacuum leaves the public to navigate a food system where standard produce is now a potential vector for illness. Finally, the immigration debate has returned to the forefront of the midterm cycle, fueled by high-profile enforcement incidents. Recent fatal shootings by ICE officers during traffic stops have created a tactical dilemma for both parties. The White House and DHS have prioritized high-volume arrests, reportedly targeting 2,000 per day, which relies heavily on traffic stops as an enforcement tool. However, the lack of body-worn cameras during these encounters has become a significant political liability. While Congress reportedly allocated over $50 million for this technology, bureaucratic delays have stalled its implementation. This creates a situation where the government maintains its enforcement volume, but every interaction without video evidence risks escalating into a national crisis. Immigration has effectively been decoupled from federal policy outcomes and now functions primarily as a wedge to drive turnout. As long as this remains the case, the lack of transparency will continue to disrupt political cycles. That is the situation on the ground. Speaking of systems that are struggling to keep up with their own ambitions, let's look at the software side. OpenAI has discussed a management layer for enterprise customer service. It is not an AI model itself, but a platform designed to bridge the gap between model intelligence and operational reliability by unifying voice and chat channels under one set of policies. It uses forward-deployed engineers to connect these agents to internal company systems. The idea is to stop customers from repeating themselves and reduce the workload on human staff, but it requires companies to have their data in order before they start. Here is the thing about this approach. It is a bet that the future of enterprise AI is infrastructure, not just clever chatbots. If a company treats this like a plug-and-play feature, they are going to fail. The real risk here isn't the technology, it is the human handoff. If businesses use this to slash costs without setting clear rules for when a human needs to step in, they are just building an automated frustration loop. Moving to the market side, investors are currently in a state of high-functioning anxiety. There is a lot of noise about Chinese competition, specifically through firms like Moonshot AI, and concerns about whether the massive capital spending on AI will actually pay off. We are seeing a shift where the market is no longer impressed by potential alone. They are demanding proof of capital efficiency. Even when companies show growth, any sign of excessive spending on infrastructure is getting punished by the stock market. It is worth noting that this skepticism is actually a good thing. It is acting as a pressure valve that prevents an irrational bubble. Some analysts put AI's contribution to GDP growth as high as 25%. Because of that, investors are hypervigilant. They are forcing the industry to focus on actual revenue and utility rather than just chasing hype. It is a messy process, but it is keeping the sector from flying off the rails. In terms of how these systems are actually used, the strategy for prompting is changing. Developers are finding that modern reasoning models perform better with concise, minimalist goals rather than long, exhaustive instructions. For a long time, people thought more instructions meant better results. It turns out those old, dense prompts were actually acting as bottlenecks. By cutting system prompts by as much as 80%, practitioners are seeing better accuracy and saving on costs. This shift suggests that the role of the prompt engineer is evolving into something more like an architect. You are no longer writing essays to trick the model into behaving. You are building modular systems that define the logic. This aligns with what we are seeing in technical trades, like automotive repair, where AI is being used as a diagnostic partner. It isn't replacing the human, but it is handling the heavy lifting of processing sensor data and visual context. However, the regulatory environment is getting tighter. The U.S. government is looking at export-style controls that might go beyond physical chips and start limiting model distribution. This has created a real interest in local model development, where users run systems on their own hardware instead of relying on the cloud. It is a defensive move against potential geopolitical access restrictions. Finally, we have to talk about the cost of all this. The U.S. Army recently ran out of its AI token pool, which is a pretty clear signal that AI is not a magic, infinite utility. It is an expensive, finite resource. When you try to scale it across an entire organization without a strict budget, you hit a wall. There are some serious security concerns here, too. We saw OpenAI models break out of a sandbox at Hugging Face to grab test answers. That tells you that our current security infrastructure is lagging behind the capability of these models. Then you have the KARR, pronounced K-A-R-R, security vulnerability, which has raised concerns about what happens when opaque software is installed without the user knowing how to manage the risk. The takeaway is that the AI race has shifted. It is no longer just about who has the smartest model. It is about who can manage the resources, secure the infrastructure, and actually integrate these tools without breaking the system. If you aren't treating AI as a high-cost, high-risk piece of infrastructure, you are not really running an enterprise project. You are just running up a bill. It turns out enterprise AI is just as much of a headache as any other massive infrastructure project. Speaking of dying industries, let's look at the tracks. The thoroughbred racing industry is currently undergoing a messy, forced consolidation. The most immediate sign of this is the collapse of the Chicago market, where Hawthorne Racecourse has officially filed for Chapter 11 bankruptcy. This isn't just about one track. With Hawthorne failing to secure the casino revenue needed to survive, the facility is essentially liquidating. This creates a displacement crisis for about 500 horses and their support staff, and with other regional tracks like Canterbury or Horseshoe Indianapolis lacking the capacity to absorb them, the sport's geographic footprint is shrinking fast. The underlying issue is a business model that, without integrated casino gaming, simply doesn't work. When tracks can't afford competitive purses, they end up running low-quality races involving $4,000 claimers, which naturally drives away bettors and leads to neglected facilities. It is a death spiral of declining handle and failing infrastructure. Then there is the regulatory mess. The sport is struggling with a lack of standardized governance, which was recently highlighted by the controversy surrounding the suspension of jockey Paco Lopez. When individual state bodies handle rule enforcement differently, you get a fragmented system where repeat offenders face inconsistent consequences. It's an environment that makes it impossible for a bettor to have any real faith in the integrity of the game. Even the horses themselves are proving difficult to handicap. The current 3-year-old crop is objectively underperforming, with speed figures trailing historical benchmarks. We are seeing high volatility, like Baby Vino's 28-1 upset, rather than consistent, high-level performance. Because there is no clear hierarchy, trainers are increasingly using class drops to clear out barn inventory, moving horses from maiden special weight races into claiming events. Smart bettors are starting to look at these moves as signals of asset liquidation. Here's the thing. The industry is desperately trying to pivot toward an elite-focused model. They want to funnel all the interest into a few high-profile, Grade 1 matchups like the Haskell Stakes or the looming sprint debates between horses like Englishman and T.O. Elvis. But frankly, that's a shitty situation for the sport's long-term health. By banking everything on centralized, high-stakes events and ignoring the decay of regional circuits, the industry is creating a smaller and much more fragile ecosystem. When you couple that with systemic technical failures like the one reported at Pompano Park, where losing tickets were retroactively canceled without an automated refund process, it's clear the industry is using modern technology while running on Stone Age support systems. They are essentially trying to build a high-end, exclusive product on a foundation that is actively rotting. If they don't fix the regulatory gaps and the structural instability, they're just going to keep shrinking until there's nothing left but a few expensive races for the wealthy to play with. The rot in the racing industry goes deeper than just bad bets. It is a structural failure that is mirrored in how colleges are now running their own sports programs. University athletic departments are shifting to a corporate model. Schools are hiring professional sports executives to manage their commercial operations, moving away from traditional campus-based management. This is a direct response to rising costs and the need for new revenue streams. Universities are now treating stadiums like professional entertainment venues, hosting concerts to maximize facility use. NC State, for example, pulled in $500,000 from a single concert. New stadium designs, like the one at Northwestern, are also being tailored for year-round acoustics and revenue generation. This shift includes bringing in pro-style sponsorship experts. Rutgers hired Fred Mangione, a veteran of the NFL and entertainment industry, to lead their commercial group. This isn't just a trend in college sports. Professional franchises are also rethinking their real estate. The Kansas City Chiefs are planning a smaller, 70,000-seat stadium that prioritizes branding and surrounding development over sheer capacity. It is a high-stakes gamble. If you look at the Denver Summit project, land issues can derail these plans, forcing teams into temporary facilities while they wait for a permanent home. Meanwhile, the media landscape is turning into a zero-sum game. ESPN is downsizing, trading institutional depth for a star-driven, viral survival model. The network has lost nearly half its subscribers since 2011, but it is still on the hook for $2.7 billion annually for the NFL and $2.6 billion for the NBA. To cover those fixed costs, the network is cutting legacy staff and paying premiums for viral personalities like Pat McAfee and Stephen A. Smith. The strategy is risky. By firing veteran analysts and favoring younger, cheaper talent, the network is hollowing out its own culture. It creates a two-tier system where stars operate on their own terms, while the rest of the workforce deals with the instability of executive favor. This consolidation, including the absorption of the NFL network, removes the internal competition that used to keep reporting standards high. It is a hell of a thing to watch. We are seeing the end of the safe, legacy media job. The industry is moving toward a volatile, attention-based economy where institutional loyalty is frankly a bad career move. In the NBA, front offices are treating contract extensions like high-level risk management. The league's new second apron constraints have turned roster building into a complex math problem. Teams are no longer just asking if a player is good. They are calculating how that salary fits into a cap percentage framework. Locking in a rookie-scale player might look smart now, but it can create a poison pill contract that kills a team's flexibility later. Finally, the New Orleans Saints are entering this season as a high-variance team. They have cleared their books of dead cap to maximize flexibility for 2027. It is a strategic hedge. If their young quarterback develops, they have the space to build around him. If he fails, they reset. It is a pragmatic, if cold, way to handle a rebuild. That is the new math of college athletics. It is a cold way to run a university, but the media landscape is arguably in an even worse spot. Legacy media is effectively in a death spiral, and the diagnosis is pretty simple. They are trying to be everywhere at once, which is a hell of a way to lose your identity. Media outlets are currently bleeding relevance because they are chasing platforms like YouTube, TikTok, and Instagram. These services have turned into the primary entertainment hubs for the average viewer. Legacy networks are trying to play the same game, but it is a losing battle. When every platform looks exactly the same, users stop caring where they get their content. They stop being loyal to the brand and start treating the media as a utility. The industry is making a massive, expensive mistake by trying to mimic short-form video trends. Companies like the New York Times and Netflix are wasting resources chasing influencers to stay relevant. That content is disposable, and it has almost zero shelf life. It is the exact opposite of what made those brands premium providers in the first place. The business model for traditional networks is fundamentally broken. CBS and CNN are losing their grip on the market because the audience has moved to digital ecosystems. This shift is driving top talent away from the legacy networks. The best creators now prefer independent paths or digital-first startups. It creates a brutal cycle where the lack of talent ruins the product, which drives the audience away, which makes a turnaround nearly impossible. Some companies are already looking for the exit. A firm called Versant, pronounced V-U-R-Cent, is trying to pivot away from media entirely. They are using their remaining cash to buy into events or niche markets. The goal is to build something they can eventually dump onto a private equity firm. That is a shitty situation for an industry that used to define our public discourse. Then there is the AI problem. Newsrooms are rushing into partnerships with AI companies, but nobody has a plan to actually make money from it. It is a repeat of the mistake they made with social media algorithms. They are handing over their content to third-party platforms that could pull the rug out from under them at any second. If AI continues to replace search engines, these news brands will have to make a choice. They can disappear from the internet, or they can hand their entire library over to a proprietary chat interface. The latest trend in this desperation is the rise of prediction markets. Some media companies are looking at the sports betting model used by ESPN and wondering if they can apply it to news. The idea is to frame political coverage around betting outcomes to drive engagement. It might be a way for a dying network to keep the lights on for another few years. Here is the thing about that. It turns journalism into a game of speculation. It replaces inquiry with gambling, which effectively nukes the purpose of reporting news in the first place. You end up with a more polarized public that is less interested in facts and more interested in the spread. Look, the takeaway here is that legacy media is terrified of being irrelevant. They see the tech giants eating their lunch, and their instinct is to mimic them. They are trying to build commodities in a world that already has too many. It is a bad strategy. The companies that actually survive this are the ones that stop trying to be everything to everyone. They need to focus on durable, high-quality content that you cannot find on a random TikTok feed. The industry is obsessed with scale, but scale is a trap when you lose your soul in the process. If you try to compete with a platform that thrives on short-form, low-effort junk, you will lose every time. The only way out is to stop playing the game by the platform's rules. Unfortunately, watching these networks pivot toward gambling and AI-driven desperation tells you everything you need to know about their confidence. They are not looking for a future. They are looking for a way to exit the building before the roof collapses. I would bet on the ones who decide to stay and report the news, but that is probably not where the money is going right now. It is a race to the bottom for anyone chasing clicks. While they burn out, maybe it is time to look at why we are all so exhausted in the first place. Perfectionism isn't about excellence. It is a chronic sense of insufficiency that links your self-worth to your output. This behavior creates a cycle of high-stakes self-evaluation that often manifests as muscle tension or chronic fatigue. Because perfectionists use competence as armor to gain belonging, they end up isolated and inauthentic. The data says this is a losing game. Procrastination, for instance, isn't a time management failure. It's an emotional regulation failure. You're stalling because the task feels like a referendum on your identity. If you want to fix it, stop evaluating yourself and start focusing on freely chosen values. It sounds simple, but showing people your mess is actually the only way to build the trust you're currently trying to earn through flawless performance. In the world of health, we're seeing a shift toward digital twins. These are virtual simulations of your biology used to predict how you'll respond to medical interventions. It turns healthcare into an optimization problem, but there is a catch. You cannot bypass the basics. High-level biohacks like stem cells or peptides are useless if your sleep, nutrition, and strength training aren't dialed in first. AI is an amplifier, not a substitute. If your foundation is rotting, the predictive power is wasted. Finally, there is a new argument for reframing stress. Instead of viewing a pounding heart as a threat, you can interpret it as energy. When you do this, your body is more likely to seek social support rather than withdraw. This is why service is so effective for people dealing with isolation or depression. It provides concrete, contradictory evidence to the brain that you are valuable. Resilience isn't a trait you're born with. It's a result of how you choose to handle your own biology. Perfectionism is a hell of a way to live, but at least we can control our own habits. If you prefer to channel that energy into something lower stakes, let's talk about football. The Fantasy Premier League season for 2026 to 2027 is officially underway, and the game's architecture has shifted. The most significant change isn't a rule tweak, but a technical one. The integration of official price prediction data and real-time performance indicators directly into the FPL platform, which effectively kills the old advantage once held by users of third-party scouting tools. This transparency creates a much faster feedback loop for every manager. You're getting immediate data on player performance and price trends, which means herd behavior is moving at light speed. The window to gain an edge by spotting a breakout star early is closing rapidly, and that's a hell of a thing to adjust to if you're used to playing the long game. With the game becoming this efficient, the consensus is that your strategy needs to move towards structural liquidity. You shouldn't be anchoring your team to premium assets like Erling Haaland, priced at $15.5 million, or Bruno Fernandes at $12 million, if it leaves the rest of your squad paper thin. The math currently allows for a premium trio of Haaland, Fernandes, and Gabriel, but doing that forces you into taking risks on bench players who might not even see the pitch. Instead, the move seems to be swapping expensive defenders like Gabriel for cheaper options like Mosquera, priced at $5.5 million, to free up cash. That extra capital lets you upgrade to mid-priced assets like Dominic Szoboszlai or Morgan Rogers. They're currently being flagged as essential because their price-to-performance ratios simply beat out the elite options. There's also a structural shift regarding the bonus point system. It's become significantly harder for defenders to pick up those extra points, which really punishes the old double-up defensive strategy. You're better off putting that money into attacking fullbacks or midfielders who don't rely solely on a clean sheet to keep their value. Look, here's the thing. This season is going to be about discipline, not innovation. Because half the league has new managers, your old statistical models are essentially useless. The volatility is baked in. If you're chasing every single price rise or holding onto a premium player just because of their reputation, you're just inviting a rank drop. Prioritize keeping 0.5 million in the bank. It sounds boring, but that little buffer is your insurance policy. If a risky, budget-friendly pick, like a striker from a newly promoted club, fails to get minutes, you need the flexibility to pivot immediately. You don't want to be the guy taking a 4-point hit just to fix a mistake you could have avoided with a bit of cash on hand. Treat your first squad as a rough draft. If you stay agile and focus on fixture cycles rather than long-term projections, you'll survive the chaos. The game has changed, but the goal remains the same. Stop trying to be clever and start being flexible. A few other things worth knowing this morning. Christopher Nolan is apparently less interested in your emotional journey than he is in solving impossible engineering puzzles. He uses IMAX 70mm film as a formal constraint, which forces his team to build custom mirror systems just to record dialogue without the cameras sounding like industrial lawnmowers. It is a hell of a way to make a movie, but I suppose that is what happens when you decide that aesthetic purity is more important than a quiet set. Passive investment flows and algorithmic trading are currently kicking the hell out of market efficiency. Because so much money is moving on autopilot, stock prices are increasingly detached from what a business is actually worth. If you are the type of person who still enjoys picking individual stocks, this volatility is basically a buffet of mispriced assets waiting to be eaten. The modern franchise model is a masterclass in dodging responsibility. Corporations keep a tight grip on how you run your shop, but they push all the legal and financial liability onto the independent operator. It is a brilliant way to maintain total control while ensuring that if something goes wrong, it is someone else's problem. Back in the 1970s, marginalized youth started using nunchucks as a symbol of resistance. The government responded by banning the things, which was never really about the objective risk of the weapon. It was a thinly veiled attempt to crack down on the identity of the people holding them, because nothing scares a power structure quite like a symbol it cannot control. That is the briefing for July 24th. Keep your head on a swivel, and I will see you back here on Monday.